Welcome back to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast. The recap of La Flèche Wallonne men and women's. The men's race for the first time in a few years precedes the women's race. In the past, the women's race has started at like 8:30 in the morning. But in fact, it finished today at 6 p.m. So they moved it all the way. Now almost too far, because there's like a half hour, 40 minute gap in coverage between the men's finishing and the women's starting, which is a little bit unusual. But anyway, probably better, definitely better for the women that they don't have to wake up at 5 in the morning to have breakfast before they start racing at 8 in the morning. But the men's race, the parkour, a little bit different to previous years. I think less climbing overall, 200 Ks long, which is typical of a Wednesday classic. Starting in Charleroi, finishing on the Mur de Huy. They do 4 reps of the Mur de Huy. 1, 2, 3.
Yes.
I can count, which is 1,300 meters, 9.7%, but really it's a K at about 11% with some steep pinches in there before it levels off to the finish line. There's also some rollers, the Côte d'Aref, 2.2 Ks, 5.4%, which is 12 Ks before the Mur de Huy as well. In terms of the favorites, it was Dylan Teuns, Skjelmose Pidcock, so with no Pagacha on the start list, or Remco. It was, yeah, a different set of favorites in the race. Benji, who got in the breakaway, and what was the weather at the start?
First of all, weather from the start was actually relatively good. I was looking at sunny conditions when the breakaway formation happened. Calmejean in the breakaway, Jusom in the breakaway, James Whelan Juaristi from Euskaltel, Chan, the ex-Asian continental champion from Astana, and Johan Mainz from Bingle, who's been riding some decent results, actually, like a bit under the radar there as well. So 6 riders in the breakaway, and then the weather started changing. And when I'm saying changing, it went from like relatively sunny conditions, still relatively cold, to actual freezing torrential rain. At a certain point, the camera, it looked like the rain was going horizontally. Right? And then the snow started occurring, and I was like, fuck, man, these conditions are horrible. And at that point, the race switched from being a watt per kilo test on the Mur de Huy at the end to an attrition race, eh?
Yeah, this turned into La Flèche Wallonne that I'd never seen before since watching the race. Normally, it's you tune in 5Ks to go and watch them do a 3-minute whack up the Mur de Huy watt per kilo test. But this was anything but that. And I got to admit, I was in the mountain. I'm a plastic fan. I was in the mountains at this point. I wasn't even, this was with like 90, 100Ks to go. No self-respecting human is watching Flèche Wallonne with 100Ks to go. I'm sorry, except the commentators and friends and family.
I'm sorry, but I got a message on WhatsApp in our group chat from Luke, the producer, and he said, Flèche Wallonnes are happening. Flesh echelons were happening, and I was like, let me open the stream. And I look at the stream, and I see a situation where, indeed, that breakaway is still ahead. They're suffering in rainy conditions, horribly freezing rain conditions. Peloton behind is 2 pelotons suddenly. And I gotta be honest, man. We're talking throughout the entire season about teams not being recognizable because all the jerseys look the same. When it's raining, every team looks the same. They've all got black rain jerseys, except Bahrain. Like, how am I supposed to know the difference between this team when they're all looking like they have black jerseys on, black jackets? It was getting difficult to recognize who was in Group 1 and Group 2. But in Group 1, we did see EF pacing and UAE pacing. And in Group 2 was rumors of Grégoire being behind, Matthews, and Vlasov. What's your first take?
Well, it was very strange because I went and rewatched it and really looked at what happened. And the weather was kind of good before, 10 degrees. Okay, not sunny. At the start, it was not that bad. But then, yeah, they just got hit with this, with hail. And I was thinking, it must be Adam Hansen's day off, or I don't know, but this is snowing on the riders as well. And Cameron Wirth, you can see there's an image of him going up one of the climbs and the hail's bouncing off his black jacket. He'd been pacing. And the teams, it's like some of them, like Ineos, evaporated. Maybe literally. Like they were all at the front and then all of a sudden you can't see them anymore. And I think after the race, Tobias Holland-Johannessen said, the Norwegian on UNOX said, yeah, we knew the bad weather was coming. We dressed for it. We prepared for it. And if you look at every UNOX rider, long gloves on, they got a head, a full beanie on underneath their helmet. And like, if the weather changes very quickly and the races and people, someone starts pushing, you can't go and put a head cover on under your helmet in 2 seconds. Like, even if you put a jacket on and, UNOX were prepared for it. But UA, Benji, that was a strange thing. They were pacing before EF. They had it in a line. Mm-hmm. Almeida's off the back. Ayuso's off the back. And here she's trying to get dressed because here she was in like not very much clothing. He didn't have long gloves on. He didn't have, he just had a gilet over a long sleeve jersey. And they were sending it with Novak.
Well, that didn't make sense to me. I didn't see it at first, but you rewatched it, you saw it. Like, I've got this feeling that UAE without Wellens and Pogacar is summer team. Like, sorry, but if this is raining like this today, Almeida ain't gonna be there. Like, he ain't gonna be there. Ayuso, I don't have that feeling with Ayuso either that he's gonna be there in like hell and so forth to be there at the front of the race.
Or
he's
Ulisi.
Got a dog in him, but not the weather dog. What?
Yeah. Or Ulisi.
Well, he was actually, unironically,
he was
the one that eventually
it,
came back and got dropped the latest off of the entire team. So, credits to you, Lisi. But this team was suffering, man. Because, like, well, they did that move, but afterwards they did what you said Ineos did as well. Evaporate.
Yeah, they brought... So, UAE, basically, when the weather starts, how I see it, they push it, split the race, they create the situation where... it's very difficult to go back and get dressed because 100Ks to go normally, you can go and get dressed like in flesh. I'm sorry, it's not that serious at that point, 2 hours to go. But they push it, then the whole team DNFs. And then EF are like, well, all right, we'll go pick it up. And then UNOX come and UNOX are like, fuck, there's nobody here. We got six riders. Every favorite's dropped or dropping or they're all going to get dressed. We're already dressed. And UNOX just start sending. And push it. So congrats, hats off to them.
Spoilers, if I had to guess, I'm relatively sure that every UNOX rider that started this race finished the race. And there are multiple teams where everybody did not finish. And some riders that were dropping early. Let's talk about it. Eh? We've gone through the first X amount of kilometers now. We're now moving towards the second Col de Ref in the race, basically. And EF still pacing, Bilbao is dropping. Vlasov's dropping. Dylan Teuns is dropping. Michael Matthews is dropping. Hirschi is in trouble, like we said at UAE. Dropping. Comes back a bit. Drops later. And on the next Muir de Huy, just before it, I see two riders next to each other. Skjelmose, suffering like crazy, basically dropping, caught in the second group. Pidcock, in that same group. Tom Squeens as well, but he seemed to use the next Muir de Huy to fly past everybody and make it back to the front of the race. So I don't know whether he was changing into a rain jacket or whether he had a mechanical or something, but he was still flying and was able to get to the front again at that point. But at this point, like, all the favorites of the race are gone.
Yeah, all the top four or so favorites, or even more, are gone. Even, like, it's not just small GC sort of style riders like Matthews as well, like, he's gone completely. This might have been a stage for Matthews the way it turned out in the end, but I don't know whether it's some riders dealing with the weather physically better or they prepared with their clothing better or it's a combination of the two. Certainly, it was very, very, very cold. Like, the snap change in temperature, it must have been very, very, very cold with the rain, which we'd see in some of the images on social media later, but some teams look good, like Alpecin, they looked okay, and UNOX, as we said, they look perfectly fine. So the peloton all of a sudden with 64 or 60Ks to go after the second Muir de Huy is like 30 riders. Yeah. And it's also very difficult to see who is who because everyone's now wearing a black jacket. We see Stevie Williams is there for Israel without too many teammates, maybe a Simon Clark for a while if he started the race. There was one other Israel for a while. And Søren Krogh Andersen anticipates, I think, with 60Ks to go. Hulgaard for UNOX tries to go with him, but then gets caught in the Shaftesbury, never goes across. And now there is a lot of riders take this opportunity when there's a lull in the peloton to go and get dressed. But no, it goes back. Quinton Hermans goes back because the long finger gloves, the ones that are good and work, the cuff is so tight that if your hands are freezing on the bike, it's with one hand, it's extremely difficult to pull them on. And so you see, I think Arthur Van Dongen trying to helping him put the glove on. But if the race is on, you can't do that. But now some riders like Schuurens Benoot, who had been dropped before, get dressed properly.
I will say this attack by Søren Kura Andersen, this was a super perfectly timed attack, in my opinion. You got this group, 30 riders. The only team that has like prominent domestiques is Yono X that has their entire country there. The entire country of Norway was there. But the attack of Søren Kura Andersen, I still remember vividly. The Tour de France stage wins that he did win were those late attacks, those perfectly timed attacks. So 90% of the time, he's got this sense for the perfect timing. Every now and then, he then decides to go on like the Corticeira or something in what is it, E3. But we'll put that aside for now. But most of the time, when he won races, it was because of a perfectly timed attack. And I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was brilliant for Søren Kura Andersen to make this move because, well, we saw the situation afterwards. The only team that did have a domestique was Yono X, and they had that rider, which they used to bridge instead of face down. So Yono X is basically deciding to have Hulgaard in between there for it. The gap was already 30 seconds, so it's hard to bridge that when you're Hulgaard at that point. It's like it all came together for Søren Kura Andersen to actually be competitive there because the gap started growing to 45 seconds, to a minute, to a minute 15. And when we start the Muur de Wee, the third one, so the second last Muur de Wee with about 35 kilometers to go, the gap is a minute 30 at the start of that climb. And I'll be honest, at a certain point, I said to myself, this could unironically be a Søren Kura Andersen victory. Did you believe in it?
I did, because the chase behind us, like, who's going to chase? FDJ have lost riders, and Visma, they got two domestiques, but they're going to pull all out. It really looked like Søren Kura Andersen. The only thing he could have done maybe better, but it's something outside of his control, is if he goes with Hulgaard. So if Hulgaard or if a Yono X guy went with Søren Kura, like Hulgaard, and they stay together for a while, then that would have been really, really, like impossible to bring back, I think, because Yono X had the most domestiques in the race. So it was really, I think, a good move for Søren Kura. I just missed that one essential element that would have made it a success in the end. But on that second last Muur de Wee, who jumped first? So Søren Kura lost like 30 seconds. I think it was Santi started pacing.
So basically, the way I saw it was that Stephen Williams jumped on that climb. And behind them, we saw Buitrago pacing to get away from...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Els being there, Volkeland being there, Carapaz being there. And that created a group behind the front rider, which was Søren Kura Andersen. So Søren Kura Andersen ahead, and those riders formed like a second group. So Stevie Williams, Van Gils, Volkeland, Buitrago, Carapaz. Yono X takes control of the peloton then and starts pacing there. Did we miss anything on that climb?
I don't think so, but it already became clear to me that like these are the strongest riders, because if Williams went away without trying just about, and if you're Benoot, Schuurens, or I don't know, pick another second tier favorite here, there's no way, Benji, you would say, I'm going to let Carapaz, Van Gils, and Schelmoser and Volkeland go up the road. No, it's not you're not choosing to do that. It's you don't have the legs to be in that group. Because for all you know, that group, or Tobias Johannesson. Maybe he trusts his teammates, but these look like the best riders in the race, and they were actually in the end. So that group, Maxim Van Hills, Lotto, Vauclin, Arkea Samsic, Santiago Buitrago, Bahrain, Richard Carapaz, EF, Stephen Williams sits up when he sees them just behind him, and then you have five of those riders. They're pacing, and UnoX start chasing full gas behind with the help of Stan Mitet, for Benoit and Tobias Holland Johannesson. So it was interesting also to see the rain jackets. Like Santi's rain jacket compared to Søren Kral's was not the most aero thing I've ever seen.
That's very true. But I will say that I felt like on the second last Mur de Huy and even the one before, we already started feeling who were the strongest in the group. And like Stephen Williams' attack on that second last Mur de Huy was really strong. He gapped everybody. Van Hills looked good. Those riders in that second group looked good. But outside of that, also the other riders, to me on that second last Mur de Huy, Stone Mitted looked stronger than Benoit. Benoit was kind of struggling at the back of the group at that point. So I didn't really know whether he was going to survive for too much longer on that climb. And we saw some other riders where I was like, ooh, that one might not survive for too long. I swear Grégoire was also a bit behind at a certain point on that climb. So I was starting to question, oh, who's going to be the leader for each team then going into the last 35-ish kilometers. But like you said, you know, X-pacing, that second group being cooperative, Søren Kral Andersen's chances towards the last 20 kilometers, towards the last 10 kilometers, started deteriorating properly. Yeah. Like, I'm not sure how much it is of him perishing versus actual cooperation starting to happen behind him, because cooperation was kind of lacking when the gap went up earlier. But I don't know. Anyway, Søren Kral Andersen gets closer and closer to the riders behind. They are on their way to relatively catch him. And there's this uncategorized hill with about 10 kilometers to go.
Oh, there's is before that... then.
Oh, yeah, it's you're right.
On Côte d'Aref, he's caught and the group two sits up. And so it's basically peloton agrupado before that categorized hill, and it's back to being the 35 guys. Were you surprised? Well, yeah, onto that uncategorized hill. Altogether, you've got now the favorites. Like Stephen Williams looks the strongest. And Stevie Williams dropped Poggy on Montjuïc. I'm going to say he did. Like he had him under pressure at least. Poggy wasn't dancing away from him. He was clearly the strongest on second last Mur de Huy. Okay, maybe he's overinvested too much on the there chasing, but didn't look that way. He actually was kind of chilling. Surely other teams, maybe Maxim Van Hills, know because he's really like has a good chance, or Vauclin. Why are UnoX the only team that tried to jump before the final Mur de Huy, especially when basically a lot of the teams or leaders are isolated? Like Williams has no teammate and he's sitting second wheel trying to follow everything. Why were UnoX the only team jumping?
There's multiple reasons you can think of, but on one end, I'm like, first of all, we don't know whether these riders had anything left. That's one thing, because this has been a very attritional race. So I'm thinking, okay, if you're four riders with Decathlon Agesaire, for example, on paper you'd say, or Godon could use this moment to try and anticipate, because they still have Cosnefroid and they have multiple riders left that could help out. So there's one rider that could have gone there. Then you look at Carapaz and Healy. Healy could have gone earlier, because I'd expect Carapaz to be better on Mur de Huy than Healy, for example. Then I look at Quickstep, Van Wilder did try a few times before the last climb, so credit where credit is due. Kroon was dropping earlier, so I don't think he actually could. But I just had that feeling that with the other teams, with the other riders, it was more of a thing of, oh, I can't really do it anymore. And then I'm looking at that UnoX move and... Go ahead.
Well, the way Visma rode made no sense to me. I really don't...
Oh, yeah, fair.
What Visma did, they acted like they were going to the final Mur de Huy with Pogacar.
To me, this was typical Palmares hierarchy at work. Because Benoit in the past has been the stronger rider of those three. You ride for him at this point, and like I said, I didn't feel like he was the strongest on the second last Mur de Huy.
What's his chance
in the
of
first
winning?
Place.
10Ks to go if the group comes to Mur de Huy.
Well, I said it in the preview. I don't believe Benoit can win Flèche Wallonne.
It's
period.
Like, I'm glad he, and credit to him for being here. He had a his family increased by one last night. He was apparently up all night last night. His wife just gave birth, but okay, that aside, 10Ks to go. He's not winning. Stevie Williams, without trying, just put 10 seconds into him on second motor week. He's not winning. So to then control the race, and they should have been doing exactly what UNOX were doing with Stan Limited, who gets like an insane wet weather buff, and Tim Van Dyke, who bizarrely was there. And yet they're controlling the race, and Stevie Williams has been laughing. He's like, I've got no teammates. I'm clearly the best puncher here.
And he's second in second wheel. Race. He's sitting in second wheel.
And Stan Mitch is just driving it.
Brilliant. Brilliant. But and I
it's
agree. Like,
and it's not even locking up a podium spot either. I'm sorry, but Vauquelin, so really, like, really strange and tactics from Visma there. But anyway, and that's how they go. They come into to the base of the Murderwee. Decathlon does a lead out for Benoit Cosnefroy. Scoins is there. He's getting stronger as the race progresses. If this was 250Ks, Scoins just wins by 10 minutes, but it's not. It's 200. And it's a stalemate. Benoit, Benoit, Scoins, Vauquelin, Guillaume Martin, sort of three or four across blocking. And actually, position and being blocked matters a lot on the Murderwee because then they're all just riding side by side. Stevie Williams behind a bit.
Yes, but I also want to kind of add the point to it. How much does, for example, spending your energy and moving up on the early parts of Murderwee cost you when you can move up more on the second part when it's suffering? So there's like a trade-off that you're making, right? For example, Van Hills in this situation goes into the foot of Murderwee in like 15th position? Far from ideal. He's like five wheels behind Benoit, who also didn't start in the perfect position on this climb. So we're looking at this point of like Van Hills needs to move up. Then he has to move up on the early segment, for example, of Murderwee. And then you arrive at the steeper segment. For some reason, with 500 meters to go, he starts taking off his gloves. That was the funniest shot of the entire Murderwee.
Maybe he could shift. Van Hills
biting off his gloves.
Maybe he couldn't shift with it on? Yeah, it's a bit of a strange thing to be focused on. But I actually don't know the answer to that. I have to look at it too, because as you're right, Benoit, he lost a lot of positions. He couldn't follow Van Dijk in the wet run-in. He just kept losing positions, whereas Benoit, bang, he's brought to the front. It looks like it's fresh, and then he doesn't have to move up on the steeper section. Stevie Williams waits for a gap, and then it opens up on the left-hand side, 300 meters to go, and he launches, and there can only be one winner. When you see a gap that big and he keeps it going, yes, the others were surprised, but no, they couldn't respond even if they weren't surprised. Butrago tried to respond, and he couldn't. And it's actually Vauquelin. Maybe Vauquelin, he was a little bit boxed behind Benoit, but in the end, Williams wins pretty comfortably after looking back seven times. Kind of looked like Dan Martin actually crossing the line. Did Dan Martin win this or just Liège? No.
Almost won every time.
Stevie Williams wins, being the third rider this year to win a World Tour stage race and a World Tour Classic. The other two being Tadej Pogacar, I had to remember, and Matteo Jorgensen. So he's in pretty exalted company there. Ahead of Kevin Vauquelin, 320 UCI points. Thanks for coming, RKBNB Hotel. Keep calling him Samzik. Maxim Van Gils, third for Lotto Destiny. That's their best result of the Classic so far, unless I'm mistaken, Benji. Benoit Cosnefroy, fourth. Butrago, fifth. Tobias Haaland-Johannessen, sixth on 10 seconds. Grégoire, seventh. Gaudin, eighth, after doing the lead out for Benoit, which is kind of crazy. Benoit, ninth. Guillaume Martin, 10th. Champoussin, 11th. So Arkea did pretty well all around. Then Schoens, Carapaz, 13th. I'll note for you, four out of the top five riders, Williams, Vauquelin, Van Hills, Butrago, were in the move chasing Søren Krah after the second last Murderwee. It's only Carapaz who struggled afterwards. So they were the strongest riders in the race.
Yep.
And that was borne out on the last Murderwee. I mean, this is the most exciting Flèche in terms of total excitement for, got to be for 20 years, Benji.
Yeah, exactly. It depends on how you view the previous flashes, because I just considered them a 2 kilometer range, except that one edition where everyone saved on the crash then turned into a bush. But this edition was much longer to enjoy. There was actual tension from, like, what is it, 70 kilometers out, 80 kilometers out, when the weather started hitting. But on the other hand, we also got to look at the factor that the weather was probably a horrible experience for the riders, while it was a fun experience to watch for us, you know? Because, for example, Schielmose, he was shaking like crazy when he DNF'd today, to the point that he had to be carried because he literally couldn't walk anymore. A little track officer then did report that he's okay, that the bus warmth solved it for him, some hot drinks and some hot shower. So that's good to hear, but that's like straight up hypothermia, right? Like the way he looked?
Yeah, he didn't look good. He was shaking, not just like shivering, but like fully shaking and shutting down. So that was, yeah, crazy to see. And even the guys who quote unquote, you know, were fine, mm-hmm. like Benoit Cosnefroy, who ends up finishing what, fourth? Mm-hmm. He, at the end, he was like, I'm freezing. I feel so cold at the end. And so that's the interesting question, Benji. I mean, not to I mentioned a few times, but like, there will be weather in the Giro that's less bad than this.
Yeah.
With much more time to go back and get a jacket. Everyone knows it's coming. The racing isn't on. And you can all prepare for it properly. And we've seen that in previous years, where the race is neutralized or the course is changed. I don't even think that's necessarily the wrong thing in stage races. So like in a one day race, if the weather turns bad, then you have a different flesh for once. And the people who prepared for it, you know, X, and the people who endure it better, like Vauquelin, they get the good result. Schielmose doesn't win today, but he doesn't win today. But if a Grand Tour is 21 stages, do you want, like, the 44 riders finished today?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want the whole GC changed by really bad cold weather on a misc stage? That's sort of,
yeah, but
if we're going to have different rules between one days and grand tours, so there's not different rules but different application of the rules,
it's also a different look at the races, you know, because if you neutralize or you impact a one day race, it's over. Like, it's one day. If you do that on a sprint stage or one mountain stage, there's still plenty of terrain to fight on. That makes sense, because like, I think that's the main difference between the two. But if the weather is serious enough, it shouldn't matter whether it's a one-day race or a stage race. I think today, it's hard for me to judge because I wasn't on the bike. So these riders are better to judge. But seeing Schielmose didn't look great. Seeing the other riders, it's like, is this too dangerous? I don't necessarily feel that. But then again, I'm biased because I just like entertaining cycling too.
Well, yeah, it's up for the riders to say, and I would have thought that hail and snow is the extreme weather protocol. That being said, there were actually less crashes than one might. They weren't that bigger crashes.
Didn't I read somewhere that they changed the extreme weather protocol to a specific set of rules based on some actual, like, analytical numbers that then decides whether it can be? I think there was a change to that recently that we forgot to mention on the podcast.
They increased it to include the hot weather, but I don't know about, I can't remember that part of it. But yeah, it's just something to bear in mind, is that I don't know the answer. Obviously, yeah, it's it was like crazy weather today. But then if you ask UNOX, they would say, well, we had 7 riders in group 1 because we dressed properly. So is it
But
is it that about extreme?
About that, how much is it being dressed properly and the conditions that they are used to training in? Because I remember Thor Hushovd roasting his riders 2 weeks ago because they should be training in sunny Côte d'Azur instead of in Norway every time. But I think it helped for today.
Wait, he wants them to train in the Côte d'Azur?
Yeah, in sunny places like other teams where, like, I don't know, where their training camps are happening. Instead of, for example, there was article recently.
But they signed 28 Norwegians.
Yeah, exactly.
But the Norwegians are crazy. And Norwegians are crazy. There was a snow dump here the other day. I'm talking biblical shit in Andorra. Open Strava, don't admit it, did 100Ks or something. I swear to God, it with the wind and the rain, it would have felt colder than minus 10. It would have colder than that. It was like 30 centimeters of snow, 20 centimeters of snow at 1,300 meters. I think he lives even higher. And he went and trained, did 100Ks. And this is his best race of the year by far. This is the best Stalin admits it's ever looked in a World Tour race. He finished within a minute after pulling the last hour. So, yeah, I think to your point, the Norwegians, it seems maybe they're just accustomed to it. Yeah, they're just built different. I don't know.
Danish people apparently not looking at Skelmore. So yeah, finger cut. He's okay, I can joke about it.
Vingegaard sees some rain in Camino. He's like, shut this whole race down. I ain't doing this. So, yeah, the Norwegians, they... Anyway, it was definitely a very different flesh. I think Williams, regardless, was underrated.
Yeah.
Even if it had been sunny, I think he's finishing on the podium or top five anyway. So Williams is a deserved winner. We haven't really spoken enough about him. Like he was on Bahrain for his career after joining from U23s in SEG. He was really, really talented. He's always been a winner, even though he hasn't had the best seasons. Like, he's always had a nice sprint on him. In 22, he won a Tour de Suisse stage ahead of, some good riders. But still, it's a Tour de Suisse stage. Like, it's a World Tour race. But he just never really kicked on. And
Was Shackman, that the sprinty thing?
Shackman and Krohn.
Oh.
I think Van Wilder was in the group too. But I feel like Israel this year have really... they've sent him to the right schedule. So last year, he didn't do TDU, didn't do any of the Ardennes Classics. Maybe he wasn't good enough, I don't know. But he won Arctic Race of Norway. But this year, he won TDU and then did Forndrome, Fornardesh, Cadels, punchy races. Wasn't that good there. Then in Catalunya, he was cooking on the punchy stages and his sprint looked good. And then today... He gets the job done on the Murder Wee. So big congrats to the 27-year-old Welshman.
Exactly. It's a performance that, with all the stuff that came before, we're looking to when we're saying, okay, that's like he gradually won bigger and bigger races, right? And to finally see him get that big hitter, that's the stuff we were looking for. And now I'm curious, like, what's next for him? Because like with Williams, you're thinking, okay, why not Giro? Because he's not doing it, eh?
He should be doing the Giro. I already said this before this race. He should be doing the Giro. Israel can take the Maglia Rosa with Williams on stage one.
Could compete for it, that's for sure.
Yeah, he can. It's realistic. Like, it's not like Geraint Thomas or somebody. They can't do it. Yeah. Williams actually can. Maybe Turns is going, I don't know. What's interesting as well, I would like to know, Benji, if Dylan Turns is in this race in good weather, mm-hmm. what do they do? Do the two just do the Murder Wee themselves, or does Williams have to lead Turns out?
I'm actually very uncertain, because on paper, Turns has a history at this race. Eh? He won the race. He's podium to race.
On Bahrain, bear in mind. He's in good shape.
He was looking in great shape as well this year, so...
Yeah.
But also, how much help do you need on Murder Wee? You get both your riders in position, and then they can try and figure it out, you know?
I think it makes a difference. Definitely on the earlier bits.
Yeah. You're not wrong. I don't know what they would have done, generally. Can't tell
you. Yeah, that's what I would be interested to hear. Maybe they were wanting to open it up early. Maybe he goes early. Who knows? that's all from the men's race. Certainly a flesh will learn that I will remember. And I get punished for thinking it would be the last 5Ks worth watching. The women's race finished about 6 o'clock. It started in Huy and finished in Merdawi, finished on the Merdawi. 143Ks. They do 2 laps of the Merdawi rather than 3, which would, I think 3 would be the right proportion, given it's still 150Ks.
There's just been a massive change when it comes to parkour compared to last year, because last year they were still on the old flesh parkour with the Shirava and so forth.
Yeah.
And now the women's parkour has dropped into the men's pattern where you've got those 2 laps with Erev Mudahui, but in the first half of the race, I feel like there's more climbs. So it's a weird vibe that I didn't really know what was going to happen in the race, if that makes sense. Because let's be honest about it. We can spoil already. You said about 3 minutes ago, I was mistaken when I thought this would be a last 5 minutes thing on the men's race. Well, the women's race was a last 5 kilometer watch.
Oh, dude. There was, yeah, maybe 15.
No, I'm not sure about that.
I just realized why they don't do 3 laps of the Murui. It's because the men's race is still finishing up there if they were going to pass it earlier.
Makes sense.
So that now makes sense to me, now that I think about it for more than 2 seconds. But yeah, there's a breakaway. Sarah Martin, Julie van der Velde, both pretty strong riders. There is an attack with about in the last hour from Grace Brown and Roy Akers. Brown has had success in the past in the Ardennes, trying to anticipate early. I think when she was chasing controversial Lizzie Deignan in a Liège.
LBL?
Yeah. That feels like 2021, 2020 region. And they had 3 minutes, but eventually that gap just, it sort of closes without, yeah, really anyone ripping it too much. It just closes because the breakaway gets tired. And the first Merdawi they do, they had a gap of 150. But I didn't see the Kopecky move, Benji. I see that in the notes. What was that? Was that post Merdawi the first time?
Yeah. So basically, second last Merdawi, we've got a bit of a move. It's like over the top. You see Kopecky making a small move because the group has no tempo making going on. At this point, you still have Grace Brown and Roy Akers ahead. You still have Sarah Martin and Van der Velde ahead. And we see Kopecky making a move, ELB closing that, and then an SD Works rider on the wheel. I'm perfectly fine with Kopecky making this move. This is like the anticipation move, trying to get ahead, see what happens. Maybe she can bridge towards someone like Brown and Roy Akers and be in that group. Yeah, and ELB closing that. I also understand why they then have an SD Works rider closing that on the wheel, because ELB and Kopecky to the Murugui at the end of this race, ELB drops Kopecky. Like, that is Murugui for me. Sorry. Like, this ain't the Kopecky climb, is how I would say it. But that aside, eventually Roy Akers and Brown get caught in some shape or form, but then happens on the Côte de Rêve, that is with 14 kilometers to go. You look at the peloton, riders are dropping, Lucinda Brandt, there's a crash from Veronica Ewers on one side of the road, and then there comes an attack on the climb. Rihanna Marcus tries to anticipate on Côte de Rêve. Longoborghini reacts in the wheel. Kasia Nevyadoma reacts in the wheel. But then you're thinking, where's SD Works? Because I'm thinking, who's going to close? And we see Vollering in the background closing this herself, and in these moments, it should be Kopecky closing it.
Yeah. Kopecky is a terrible teammate. I'm sorry, but it's like in the races where it's Kopecky is the favorite, Vollering normally does the right thing, and Vollering did the right thing in Amstel Gold Race for Vibus. But today, clearly Vollering is SD Works leader.
Yeah.
Or should be. She won this last year. Like, she is their best climber. And the way Kopecky rode this final was, yeah, just unbelievable, to be honest. Like, I don't know what she was doing. Because yeah, or maybe Vollering is not, well, first of all, Kopecky's able to go on the front to close it, right? She's not completely gassed at this point.
No.
So, or maybe Vollering's, it's her fault for taking over too quickly. I don't know. I'm panicking, but we see something similar because when the break is caught, this is, I'm not sure if you mentioned the 9.5K to go attack, Shabby Benji, attacking with 9.5Ks to go. Was that on the Eraf or some random kicker?
was just over the top. At this point, Rutgers has caught the two breakaway riders, basically. So we've got three riders up the road. And the other companion, Grace Brown, is not there anymore. But like you said, Shabby makes that move. And it's on that uncategorized climb. So this Côte de Ref has like the Côte de Ref. But then like 2 kilometers later, there's an uncategorized climb that everybody seems to be willing to attack on. Because everybody's like, it's not categorized. So nobody's going to be expecting it. But everybody expects it because it's on the parkour and it looks like a climb. So people are prepared for it. Shabby attacks, catches Rooijakkers, and the rest of the breakaway is falling apart, which means that we've got the situation of Shabby, Rooijakkers being up the road, ELB bridging towards it, and Kopecky jumps from the peloton to Sarah Martin, who dropped from the breakaway, tries to use Sarah Martin to close it for her, and then eventually goes to the front. Then Kopecky's then in this group with ELB where she won't ride, but the group behind is not getting pace, so Vollering's at the front of the group again. So we have the same scenario as earlier where Kopecky should never be in that group in the first place. She should be facing the group back for Vollering if you think Vollering can win on Mur de Huy.
Yeah, because if Kopecky's in a group there and she has a chance to win from that group, it kind of makes sense. Yeah. She is never, ever beating Longaborghini on this finish. Like, on a Paardenberg, Longaborghini dropped everybody. She is probably the top three puncher in this race. In fact, I didn't even know why Elisa Longaborghini jumped into that group, Benji. I was like, why are you jumping after Elise Shabby?
Yeah.
And then not pulling, and then pulling once Kopecky's there. And in the end, it kind of did. It wasn't too bad because Vollering had to spend her energy, but the one beneficiary of this is Kasia Nuviadoma. A good tactics from Canyon SRAM. Canyon SRAM using Shabby like that meant Longaborghini jumps for some reason, Kopecky jumps for some reason, and now Vollering pulls it back and Kasia's in the wheels.
I'm going to counter your take of earlier where you said Kopecky is not a good teammate. I think she's trying to be... she's trying to do stuff with Vollering in her mind, but she's not executing it well. As in, she's not pacing with the riders in that group, so she's actively thinking about Vollering at that point. The only problem is she should have done it differently and should have been the one pacing. And then even earlier when she makes that move, when she's attacking herself, that's also not the kind of scenario where you think you're going to win from 29 kilometers out. But especially when all these attacks are being neutralized again, we go to the Mur de Huy and Kopecky is positioning Vollering at the foot, like it's as if she is trying to help, but in a co-leader kind of way. Does that make sense? And she shouldn't be co-leader in this race.
Yeah, I mean, she should be Marlon Roycerolle in this race because, Rihanna Marcus tried to counter, gets 15, 17 seconds. And at that point, it should be Kopecky on the front, drilling it, and then doing what Tim van Dijk did for Benoit, driving it as long as she can into the base of the Mur de Huy, not saving her legs to get her best possible race result, not trying to find a position in the bunch, driving it, Vollering in the wheel. And I didn't see the positioning Vollering, but they catch Marcus with about 800 meters to go. Vollering goes to the front, Anna van der Breggen style, and just starts setting her pace, which if it pays off, it pays off. It paid off last year. If it doesn't pay off, then you say, why do you go to the front so early? Maybe she wanted to just set her own pace and use her like sprint at the end. I don't know, but she does that. And there's clearly now three riders that can really go with that are good enough. Vollering, Kasia Nuviadoma, and Elisa Longaborghini. And those three ride, they ride, they ride. And I'm like, is Kasia going to go? Is she going to go too early? She always goes too early. She waits and eventually she jumps. And for once, we see a gap open up. And Kasia Nuviadoma uses that punch that she has, which we saw on the Kalberg in 2021. And she dances away from Vollering and Elisa Longaborghini. Vollering comes back to her a little bit on the flatter section at the end, but isn't able to catch back up. Kasia winning by 2 seconds ahead of Vollering. We did it. We said she had to win. Mission accomplished. We got him.
Finally, man.
5 years after a Tour of Britain win. 5 years. But like, not just a, she's top five rider in the world.
Yeah. And the her problem is that she's such a specific rider. She's a great climber, to be clear.
Yeah.
But when it comes to her punch, she needs to be separating herself away from people with a gap enough to hold it to the line. And she did that today because she was just the strongest on Muir de Huy. The climb really fits her. Longo Borghini had put effort on the attacks earlier. Kasia had followed an attack as well, though, that one from Marcus on Col de Def earlier. But I don't know. Like, with the whole Vollering strategy, this is the Anna van der Breggen strategy, like you said. And in my head, that is the wrong strategy, knowing that Vollering has not been the strongest in the last week when it comes to the Ardennes. That strategy is something you do when you know you're the strongest in the race. And Anna van der Breggen knew that back in the day. Vollering knew that last year. Otherwise, it does not work. You can't just ride the same pace to the top and hope people drop off your wheel if you're not the strongest. Because then you're going to get countered and destroyed. And that's what she was today.
That's what happened, yeah. And then Elise Longo-Borghini rounds out the podium in third on 4 seconds. Evita Muzic, fourth. Mulman, a nice result, fifth. Royak is sixth. Juliette Labou, seventh. Ben Van Empel for Visma, eighth. Cavalli for FDJ Suez, double top 10. And nice to see Cavalli in the top 10, although she won this race in 2022. In ninth, Anna Santesteban in 10th for the Laboral. It's the Fundación Euskadi Basque team. I think that's the Conti team. So
yep.
Big result from them coming top 10.
Great
kid. Yeah, there's one of their riders in Andorra. I don't know if it is Santesteban, but that kid is really, really nice. Shout out to Nivea Doma and Canyon. How many wins they got this year? Oh, one. It's their first win this year as well.
I thought so.
Last year they won eight races.
Yeah, and to be honest, they've still got the time to win multiple races, eh? It's not like it's late into the season, but you would have hoped you'd at least be at two at this point. Like, when's the Vuelta Femenina again?
Soon. It's soon. It's in like 2 weeks or something.
Jesus, just before the Giro or during the Giro.
Because there's the Basque Country Women's Race, Burgos, and yep. La Vuelta, and actually all three are very close together, and it sort of kind of is a three-week Grand Tour, but not really. there's a lot of Spanish racing coming up. Yeah, Canyon-SRAM, they didn't win a World Tour race for 4 years, from 2019 to 2023, and now they're back. They won three last year and eight total victories, including a Tour de France stage win, and now this year they win... Yeah, La Flèche Wallonne is their biggest classic win in, I don't know, I have to go back pre-COVID. So big result for them, big result for Nivea Doma. Really, really happy to see her win. And what do you think this means for Liège, Benji, both in the men and for the women? I don't think this changes too much for Liège in that they had the better run of weather. It seems the riders weren't freezing at the finish. The strongest riders will be the strongest riders on Sunday, but for the men's race, yeah, I think a lot will have been taken out of them. Any other, but from the women's, anyone else that, like young rider that stands out?
Well,
it's kind of familiar names in the top 10, to be honest. They're all experienced riders except for Van Empel.
Yes, exactly. And also, I hadn't known that much about Greta Marturano, that got 11th, if I recall correctly. Gaskin also, again, with a solid result, 13, obviously, after Amstel. She might have hoped for more, but she shows that she's not dog shit in other races either. Now, I got to be honest, we're going to have a separate preview, most likely, for LBL, but I've got this vibe of SDWorks having to go to the drawing table for the Ardennes Classics is not something I would have expected after last year's Tour de France Femme, because
yeah,
they've really not been dominant this year. They've really made a step backwards when it comes to, like, Kopecky had the victories, Roubaix, Strade, and Jebel Hafid, but they made a step backwards when it comes to the classics. Hill Classics, same story, but now they don't have the victories. So now I'm looking at LBL as the final opportunity in these Ardennes Classics to deliver that, and Full Ring doesn't look strong enough to separate herself from others. And then I'm thinking, can she outsprint at the finish line? Perhaps. She's got a solid sprint. But Kopecky's also riding that. Do you need to anticipate very early with Kopecky, or do you place her in the Royce rule role where she's a full-on domestique on the last climbs? When, yeah, it's...
They are going to sell her out in so many races this year. Again, Vollering. I'm telling you.
Hey, like, don't she's be leaving, so...
She should. Like, yeah. It's ridiculous. You got, like... If you look at the watts per kilo difference from Vollering in the Tour last year and the difference in her and the next best rider, it's huge. She's, like, by far the best climber.
Yep.
Yeah, it's just my head scratching to me. Royak is probably the strange one, is that she was in that move with Grace Brown. She ended up sixth here on 15 seconds. So I wonder how she would have finished without being in that move in the end. But, yeah, that's La Flèche Wallonne women. Other race news, Tour of the Alps yesterday was a solo breakaway win for Alessandro De Marchi. Ineos were chasing for Ganna, but Thomas had a mechanical, so they stopped chasing. And then today, I haven't seen it, but it looked like Juanpe Lopez went solo maybe at the end of the last climb and took, I don't know if he was in the break, but it took 22 seconds on Pellizzari, who is that. He came, I think, third in a stage last year, actually, behind Mühlberger and someone else, or Conrad. And then Foss came third, leading a group of the GC guys, Bardet, APP, O'Connor, Pools, Tiberi. Geraint Thomas got dropped. He lost 3 minutes.
Foss leader.
Harper also lost 2 minutes. I was quite surprised by. Zana lost 2:11. Igita lost 3:24. Carthy lost 4 minutes. Chavez lost 10 minutes. I think it was bad weather again today.
Yeah. As Flesh. But most importantly, El fucking Patron's done
it. El Patron's
his
back.
First pro victory for Juanpe. He's been in the Maglia Rosa before, but he never actually got a stage when he got destroyed by Kemna on Etna, for example. And when it comes to GC, like, Lopez being in the lead by 31 seconds, it's in a very difficult mountain stage tomorrow. So I actually don't know whether he can do it. Like, Foss is the closest contender on 31, O'Connor on 45 seconds. I still believe that O'Connor could win this race, but it's very open right now, which is good. I like it. I want a Bardet descend raid. That's why I live now.
Yeah, the last stage in particular looks really tough for Juanpe. It's two long climbs, but they average 6%. And guys like Foss, Pools, O'Connor, Tiberi, Bardet even, they can put him under a lot of pressure on that sort of climb. But yeah, he's got a 31-second lead. That's nothing to sniff at. I'll have to go watch it back. Pellizzari, it's nice to see the young Italian doing well. I dare say he will be on a World Tour team next year. That's almost guaranteed. Yeah, that's Tour of the Alps, but Thomas, I don't know. He was a little bit better in 23, right?
I do not remember.
He still, yeah, 2023, he still came 15th and lost 3:32, but there he was like really a domestique for Teo, and he was sort of pulling super hard, and that's why he lost time. He wasn't trying. Maybe that was the same today. He just went gone for Foss. But
it's also...
Hopefully he's in good shape for the Giro.
The conditions today were probably not what we saw last year either, so I don't think we can compare those editions. And I'm not expecting Thomas to be good at Alps to then be... I don't need Thomas to be good at Alps for me to trust him being okay at the Giro, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Other races there are not just Liège, which we'll do a separate preview for. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed the Flèche Wallonne recap. We'll see you with the Liège preview tomorrow evening at the latest. Until then, ciao.